Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of the Power Pros podcast, Trouble on Blubalonia. I'm Chris Slate. My cohort, Chris Hoffman, isn't here this week. He's currently in Orlando riding Space Mountain, the Disney World ride, I think, and not wrestling legend Ric Flair. Although Hoff has been known to do a little Flair walking after chugging down a few too many E-tanks, so I guess you never know. Anyway, we pre-recorded part two of our NES 30th Anniversary Spectacular last week before he left, so in just a few minutes we'll get back to that so we can finish off the official Power Pros list of the system's 30 best games. But first, the news! And we're going to start off with our favorite subject around here lately.
Amiibo!
Now, Toys R Us has been going crazy this week, sending out tweets announcing all these different Amiibo exclusives they've got lined up for November. First off, there's the Mii 3-pack, which comes out on November 1st. Then there is a restock of the Villager Amiibo, which was super hard to find back when that first wave came out. That's going to be in stores November 8th. And then there's that giant stuffed animal Yoshi, basically, Mega Yarn Yoshi, comes out on November 15th. And they warn that quantities, for that will be extremely limited. Now, all of these are exclusive to Toys R Us, and they're also all in-store only. So November, I guess, officially is going to be the lineup in front of Toys R Us month. And hopefully, it doesn't go too crazy. And hopefully I don't have to kill any fools to get my giant dinosaur stuffed animal Yoshi guy. Speaking of Yoshi, Yoshi's Woolly World comes out this week on Friday. That's October 16th. Along with him, speaking of Amiibo, some more Amiibo. We've got the green Yarn Yoshi Amiibo that comes back boxed with certain versions of the game. Then there's the blue and pink Yarn versions, which are sold separately. Pre-orders for those went up at some locations about a week or so ago, so hopefully you guys got those in. If not, hopefully they're not too hard to find. They're super cute. You know, Hoff imported one from Japan like he always does, and I got to, cuddle with it a little bit, and it is awesome. Let's see. There's actually a demo for the game for Yoshi's Woolly World up now at certain outlets. I actually got to play the game for the very first time at the kiosk at Target the other night. So then again, it wasn't at another Target, so I guess it depends on how well decked out your store is. But so far, from the very little bit I played, and Hoff had played it at E3 before, I think, so I'm playing catch-up here, but it is just about exactly what you'd expect it to be if you've watched the videos or paid attention to it at all. It plays very much like a Yoshi's Island game. The graphics are adorable and just look great in HD. You can practically see the little fuzz coming off their little, fluff bodies. And it just seems like it could be that return to form that a lot of Yoshi's Island fans have been waiting to see after a couple of good but not great sequels in the interim since the original SNES Classic. Speaking of new games and Amiibo, Chibi-Robo Ziplash came out last week, last Friday, and you could get these Chibi-Robo Amiibo bundled with that game. That was the only way to get it. And I picked that up. To be honest, I'm not sure that I would have bought the game day one if it didn't have the Amiibo in there and if I wasn't so ridiculously addicted to collecting those things. And my first impressions of it so far, after having cleared all the stages and 100%ed all the stages in the first world and dug a little bit into world two, is that it's a good game. It's not a great game. Nintendo people have said that this may be the last shot for the character. The games he'd appeared in previously for GameCube and DS, I believe, were kind of cult favorites, but weren't huge critical or financial successes. I do think that the game and the characters work as a side-scrolling title, but I would kind of categorize this game with some other side-scrolling games that Nintendo have launched, such as Starfy, that are cute and fun in their own ways, but you can tell they don't have the lasting power of something like a... I mean, let's face it, you've got Nintendo platforms are famous for their platformers. I mean, you're going up against the best of the best when you enter that arena. You're going up against all the Mario games, the Donkey Kong games, the Kirby games. The list goes on and on. So side by side with those, it's nothing that remarkable. But I got to say, the Ziplash play mechanic is pretty cool, where you basically play, kind of an updated version of Bionic Commando, carrying that little power cord behind you that is plugged into Chibi-Robo, and then using that to kind of swing and bash into enemies or to swing across gaps or to reach higher places or even to sling out like a hookshot in Zelda and collect items that are out of your reach. That's really fun. Where the game falls apart for me a little bit is mainly in two areas. One, I just don't find, other than Chibi Robo himself, who is adorable, I don't find the world and the supporting characters and everything, the whole setting, to be that appealing or that kind of polished compared to what I'm used to from first-party Nintendo games. And I also feel like the tempo and the pacing of the game is a little bit stunted at times, which is kind of something I picked up on after so many Nintendo developers have pointed it out. They like to say that a Mario game, for example, is all about achieving that great pace and that great tempo, where as you're playing it, you're kind of constantly interacting and pressing buttons in an uninterrupted fashion at just the right kind of pacing so that it kind of, you know, just is really fun to kind of play and keep going and interact with that world. And oftentimes when you're playing this Chibi Robo title, I feel like either you grab an icon and he steps back to kind of do a little dance, which is kind of cute on its own, but you kind of don't want to wait for him to do that after a while. Even the best example maybe is when you start a stage and as you're kind of going from your little in-ship lobby into the actual stage, there's a couple of kind of, you know, like your little keyboard companion is like, hey, you know, good luck out there, whatever, and you have to stop and kind of acknowledge him and then you continue on. So there's a lot of, you know, you just want to get into the game and play it arcade style and it keeps kind of tripping you up. But, you know, having said all that, it's still pretty charming, and it's not bad at all. It's just got a lot to live up to on these platforms. And considering the fact that it's a 3DS title and isn't, you know, a ton of money and comes with a really cool-looking amiibo, I'd recommend picking one up. You know, just kind of set your expectations correctly. It's not going to be the next great Nintendo platformer, but it's a solid title. Now, we had that game last Friday. This Friday, like I said, we've got Yoshi's Woolly World. And then the next Friday after that, we've got The Legend of Zelda Triforce Heroes. So October is looking to be pretty stacked so far. There's been a ton of media for the game hitting lately. I mean, you can't go on YouTube without tripping over you know, videos of people playing this game. So go check it all out if you don't, you know, if you don't worry about spoilers too much. Like I said, it hits on Friday. That's October the 23rd. And today, as I record this, it's Wednesday, October 14th, Nintendo has started to send out some invitations, maybe randomly, I'm not sure how they pick, to folks to invite them to participate in the demo for the game. The demo can be played locally, and I believe can even be played with download play, so multiple people can play it. As long as they're shoulder to shoulder on the same couch. Online, you can play the game, but they've set aside certain times for it, which you can find online. Or if you're invited to the demo, I'm sure that information is made available. But there's a schedule, just like there was for the Splatfest. The Splatoon. I can't remember what they called it, but it was the early Splatoon demo, which was a very similar thing where you signed up and, you know, for certain set aside times over the weekend, you could play online. It's essentially a way for Nintendo to do a little stress test before the main game actually goes public so they can make sure they, you know, their servers aren't going to crash or whatever as soon as people start playing this game. So, you know, I don't have a code myself, but hopefully I get one or maybe Hoff gets one because the codes, as Nintendo has done in the past for other demos like Smash Brothers on 3DS and such, you can you get not just a code for yourself, but some codes to share as well. Also coming out, actually a day before Triforce Heroes, is Fatal Frame Maiden of Blackwater, the kind of very Japanese style, kind of Japanese folklore style scary title from Tecmo that is coming out here digital only. So, you know, the series has kind of a cult following. I'm really glad it had a chance to come out here. Probably couldn't have justified a physical release for this title. But it's great that we're getting an opportunity to play it if we do want to check that out. And I just might. I don't find the aesthetic or the general appeal of the series to be too strong for me. But there was a genuinely one of the most spookiest moments that I think I've ever seen in a video game came at the beginning of Fatal Frame 2. On the PS2, I believe, when the two girls, I believe they were sisters, starting out at the beginning of the game, you know, before anything really spooky had showed itself, you know, one of the girls, you see a cinematic where her sister places, you know, her hand on her sister's shoulder, and then the girl turns around. I'm sorry, no, then the girl's sister actually walks past her. So you can see both girls in the frame, and you're like, whose hand is that on her shoulder? She turns around, and no one's there. But that was a great spook moment. And if the new game has anything like that, then then I'll definitely check it out. Now, last but not least, before we clear up the news here, there is a new wave of World of Nintendo figures that are starting to show up in stores. I believe some of these were spotted in the Nintendo World store in New York, so I don't know how long it might take these to get around nationwide, but they're pretty cool. The new figures are 8-bit Mario, 8-bit Luigi, 8-bit Link, 8-bit Donkey Kong, Shy Guy, a yellow Pikmin, Skull Kid, and Dixie Kong. Now, I've been tempted to get some of these World of Nintendo figures. To be honest, I don't think the quality of them is quite up there with Amiibo, which is pretty top-notch in my opinion. But they're really cool, and you're getting some pretty obscure characters that we don't have Amiibo of, like Skull Kid. And, you know, an 8-bit Donkey Kong and 8-bit Link, that's just, you know, super cool. So, I don't know, maybe I'll break down and pick one of these up. But be on the lookout if you're interested. All right, that's about all I've got in front of me. I probably missed an item or two, and if so, I'm sure Hoff will remind me and we can touch on it next week. But for now, without further ado, let's get back to our countdown of the top 30 NES games after this break. All right, it's time for the top 15 games in our best 30 NES games of all time, the official Power Pros list. And to finish things off, we're bringing back the Hoff.
That's right. I am here and raring to go through the magic of recordings and the internets.
Time paradox. All right, so number 15.
Speaking of paradoxes.
Metal Gear.
Now, Metal Gear on the NES, you know, is sort of famous for, you know, not being as good, according to Hideo Kojima, the creator, as good as the MSX original. But as we mentioned a couple weeks ago on the show, if you hadn't played that one and the NES was your first experience with it, hey, it's a pretty excellent game.
Yeah, and just like, you know, from my very first impression of the game was actually from the ad. Mm-hmm. And I think we've mentioned this on the show before. The ad
was. We loved that ad showing all the different gear.
All the gear.
And we thought that's what Metal Gear was. It's all this cool gear. Gas masks and rocket launchers and machine guns and pistols and
back then you didn't have
landmines.
You didn't have a lot of games where you could you know, usually you were happy in a game if you had punch and kick. You know, you didn't worry about night vision goggles or, you know, different guns you could equip and all that good stuff. So the fact that there was so much in there to play with really captured my attention, and then in the game, once I finally got it, really captured my imagination.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's also known for you know, its excellent writing with lines like "Uh-oh, the truck have started to move," mm-hmm. and "I feel asleep."
Yeah, really endearing. I kind of love that about my NES games.
Yeah, but yeah, cool game regardless. Number 14 on the list is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, the arcade game. Now, TMNT on the NES, you know, it's got a very interesting history, because that original game came out, and, you know, according to the Nintendo Power, you know, poll results, it was super popular. Everybody loved that game, but almost everybody I know in real life is like, this game is terrible.
I had a weird kind of Stockholm Syndrome situation with that game, which I think I've said on the show mm-hmm. before. I was forced to play it for work, ended up beating it twice, and even though I was super frustrated, I felt like there was such an achievement. I think when I beat it, like my body released all these endorphins that made me love it in retrospect.
But we're not talking about that game. We're talking about the sequel, because the NES game came out at the same time an arcade game came out. It was just a pure beat 'em up. You could choose from any of the four characters and, you know, pound the crap out of foot soldier robots, you know, all the major TMNT characters. You know, Bebop and Rocksteady and Baxter Stockman and Krang and Shredder were all the bosses. And I just went in there and started wailing on them. And it was so much fun. It was, you know, a four-player arcade game. Only two players in the NES version. But you know, this version did come out, like, you know, I think probably a year later after the arcade game hit. Man, I remember, you know, at the time, I remember writing so many letters to Konami saying, you know, please bring this out, please bring this out. And it felt like it took, like, you know, 6 years for it to happen. But it was, you know, only like a year or less. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's got a co-op mode. It's probably one of the first games with in-game advertisement had Pizza Hut logos you know, strewn about the game.
I've forgotten that.
There was even a coupon on the back of the manual I don't think I ever redeemed it for money off of pizza. Yeah, too bad you didn't do that.
That free pizza never got a slice.
Yeah. But, you know, it certainly wasn't even, like, close to the arcade game. You know, there was nothing about it that was even close to arcade perfect. They had to make a lot of concessions, but still so much fun. Just go in there and lay the smack down with a friend. You know, they did as good as they can, and, you know, worked out pretty darn well.
Always choose Donatello.
Yeah, he didn't have quite the advantage in the NES version that he did in the arcade game, but still, that's what I would stick with. Purple Power. Moving on, number 13, Mega Man 3. It's interesting that that's coming right after Ninja Turtles, because those games both came out about the same time in 1990. I think I got them both for Christmas that year. But, you know, Mega Man, obviously, there's a ton of games in that series. You know, six that were on the NES. And, you know, Mega Man 3 is definitely, you know, near the top of the list for me. You know, it had the same formula, you know, defeat the different bosses, you know, earn their weapons, use those weapons to exploit the weaknesses. But on top of that, it also, you know, brought back, like, some of the bosses from Mega Man 2. You'd have, like, remixed versions of the stage of the bosses you defeated, and then the bosses there had the powers of the Mega Man 2 bosses. So it's one of, actually, the biggest Mega Man games, I think, in terms of the number of levels. And there's something about the graphics that just, you know, got kicked up a notch. You know, had some really nice environments. I remember the Gemini Man stage with these crystals, you know, looking super shiny, and the Snake Man stage with that giant snake monster that's constantly moving and wiggling at you, looking really cool. And, of course, the, you know, pretty giant final boss as well. You know, just, you know, fun, enjoyable game. It's the one that introduced the slide maneuver to the series, introduced Rush, Mega Man's dog, as well, plus Proto Man. So quite a landmark title in Mega Man. As well as just being, you know, solid fun.
It's a personal landmark for me because it's the first game that I ever wrote about professionally for Game Players.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, before that, my job was basically that of a they didn't have interns back then, but it was basically like an intern. Me and one of the other guys in my position got a chance to co-author the Mega Man 3 story. So
yeah, that was the cover
story. I had a copy of that somewhere. But yeah, so I guess I'll fondly remember the game for that, you know, along with just being a great game.
Mm-hmm. And next up, we have the original Ninja Gaiden. The original Ninja Gaiden.
That was always a point of contention, wasn't it? When you were a kid at school, it's like, is it Gaiden or Gaiden?
Yeah, everyone would call it Gaiden back then. I still call it Gaiden. I didn't actually mean to call it that just now, but...
old habits die hard.
Yeah.
And it is Gaiden.
It is Gaiden, but yeah. As a joke, I still tend to say
which
Ninja
means
Gaiden.
I think it means new story in Japanese.
I always thought it was like side story or something.
Oh, something story in Japanese.
But, you know, whatever you call, however you pronounce it, it is just an amazing action game. You know, it requires a lot of technique to play. You know, fast-paced, fun, memorize these patterns. It had the stick-to-the-wall play mechanic. You'd bounce back and forth between walls, and that was a whole lot of fun. You know, you'd acquire the sub-weapons, the big throwing star, or, you know, the flame burst, you know, the wheel of fire that surrounds you made you temporarily invincible, the sword slash that you could take out, you know, almost, you know, anything in your path. But the big thing, of course, that I think really sold so many people on the game was those cinematic cutscenes. You know, cutscenes weren't a thing back then.
Right. You didn't have stories in games other than what you read on the back of the box or in the manual,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, maybe there was something at the very beginning, like in The Legend of Zelda, you know, there was that text scroll. But for the most part, yeah, it wasn't very prominent.
Yeah, and this was before every level. You got a whole little next chapter of the story.
Yeah, it would be like, you know, it would say chapter one, chapter two, and then it would have these cutscenes unfold. And, you know, one of my favorites is, you know, after the first level, you know, you meet this mysterious woman, Irene Liu, and, you know, Ryu Hayabusa, the hero of the game, you know, he has this, you know, classic hilarious line, you know, just a girl, get out of here.
Yeah.
And then she shoots him. Yep.
That game also has, despite the fact that I love it, but it's kind of despite of the fact that, it has one of the most annoying things that NES games had for me. The three things that I didn't like in NES games sometimes were we had excessive flickering on screen
Okay.
and slowdown, tearing of the screen, Well, I guess that would be all lumped into one thing, the flicker, the tear, and the slowdown. And then the other thing would be when you'd have that thing where the enemies would reappear if you scrolled backward, if you scrolled the screen backwards just a little bit and came back, the enemy would be right back there.
Well, this one, it just had respawning enemies at certain points. You could be like moving along a level and there could be like this, you know, apparently wild animals hated Ryu in this game.
Like especially birds.
Bats and eagles, all manner of birds. I think, you know, like you know, jaguars or cougars, they're all trying to kill him, along with the regular bad guys. But all these forces of nature are trying to kill Ryu because he's, you know, he's a big sexist jerk saying, just to go get out of here. And yeah, but you could get to these certain points and there'd just be like a constant stream of birds or, you know, cheetahs or whatever. They're just always coming after you.
Yeah, like you'd be crouched and you didn't want to go forward because it would be dangerous for some reason. But you'd be right in the right spot where the guy you're killing across from the screen would immediately respawn and just keep sending an endless wave at you.
Yeah, you kind of had to figure out how to work that to your advantage. And that was part of, I feel like, you know, the pattern memorization that was involved in that game. And it never really bothered me. I thought that was, you know, kind of one of the fun aspects of enjoying it. Another one of the fun aspects, another rockin' soundtrack. I mean, I never really think of, you know, Tecmo as like, you know, making amazing sound. Like I always think, oh, you know, Konami has all these great soundtracks. Capcom has great soundtracks. Nintendo has great soundtracks. So I don't know where, you know, Tecmo, you know, got the composer for this one. But man, it was such a good soundtrack. I think the original totally blew away the sequels when it came to the music. And I enjoyed it more from a gameplay perspective as well.
It's one of those games I can go back to, like Castlevania, every couple of years, and despite the fact that I remember it as being an especially challenging game,
yeah, it was tough.
I can play right up to the end pretty effortlessly, and then I get stumped a little bit.
Yeah, the final bosses are especially hard.
Yeah.
Next up, DuckTales.
Wii U.
You say Wii U?
On Wii U, which it is.
There is. They made the.
How did they sequel. Not use that pun in advertising the Wii U version?
But yeah, you know, I mentioned earlier that you know, there were licensed games that bucked the trend, and boy, did this one ever do that.
The bouncy bounce mechanic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he played his Uncle Scrooge, the old rich duck who used his cane as a pogo stick to bounce on enemies.
I had really no love for the TV show or even the classic kind of Disney cartoon characters
in
the game.
Yeah, neither did I.
But it was just a great game that transcended that.
Well, it was Capcom. And you know, by then I had gotten past my anger over the ghosts and goblins, you know, screenshot incident we mentioned last week. And you know, by then I knew Capcom is like, oh, you know, everything they do is pretty awesome. You know, I was into, you know, Mega Man 2 and Strider and DuckTales. I think all came out that same year. And you know, it was, you know, very much like Mega Man in some ways. You could select which stage you went on. It had you know, similar graphic style. Similar music, and it was you know, just this core mechanic of, you know, pogo jumping on enemies and treasure chests and all this stuff was just, you know, really fun. It also added, you know, a lot of exploration because you're trying to get all these treasures and things. You could get multiple endings depending on how much treasure you got, in fact. And you know, that all added up to you know, one of the better licensed games out there. I mean, it's kind of unheard of that, you know, a licensed game is like, okay, here we are, you know, how many years later, and we're going to just remake this sucker on, you know, modern consoles. That's kind of unheard of. That really speaks to, you know, how fondly people remember that game.
Yeah, because, I mean,
what a good product it was.
Because kids today don't know anything about the DuckTales cartoon show.
Mm-hmm.
But gamers know what an amazing game that was.
Did you have a favorite level in that one by any chance?
I'm trying to think. What was there? The moon, the jungle. The jungle's the one that I remember the most, but I can't remember if that's specifically because it was my favorite or I just maybe died a lot there. I don't know.
I'd probably go with the moon just because it has the most epic song in the game.
Oh, yeah. I definitely know I like the NES original better than the re-release.
Really?
Rather the remake that Way Forward did. Yeah, I love the way that they do super smooth sprites, but I don't like the polygonal backgrounds.
Oh, yeah, I can understand that. I like them both. They're both excellent games.
Yeah, I like the retro feel of playing the original game.
But yes, a top-notch product. Number 10, Contra.
We're in the 10s now. We're at the top 10.
That's right.
There was perhaps no better like poster game for two-player co-op on NES than Contra.
I would have to agree with that. That's one that I would, you know, always pull out when I had friends over. Yeah, run and gun co-op doesn't get much better than that.
I have to admit, I never beat that game without the Konami code. And I beat some hard games, so I don't know. To be fair to myself, maybe I could have. But once I discovered there was a code to get 30 lives or whatever, mm-hmm. I never went back.
Well, that's, you know, one of the cases where having this cheat code, I think, actually made me a better gamer. Because at first, you know, it's really hard to make any progress in the game. But, you know, I would always use that 30-man code. You know, especially in co-op, because, you know, like you get to the third level and you're going up the waterfall and you're scrolling each other off the screen, you're killing your friend's killing you. And,
yeah.
Yeah, those levels could, or those lives could drain pretty fast when you're doing that. But, you know, when I was playing it with these 30 lives, it actually gave me a chance to learn all these patterns and figure out what to do and how to not die. And I wanted to be like, okay, I actually want to get good and not just, you know, throw all these lives away. And actually, I got to the point where I could actually beat it, starting with just three lives. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. I tip my hat to you. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I learned to get pretty far, you know, before I would ever lose a life. I'd be able to, like, build up, like, you know, five or six guys, you know, stored up.
You know what I can still picture perfectly clear in my head is the little pink, 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 pink sound that your bullets make when they're hitting something. I think particularly, I don't know if it's a different sound when they're hitting an enemy or hitting metal or something, but there's a specific sound they make that was very unique.
Well, it had those, you know, cool pseudo 3D stages on levels 2 and 4. And is that what you're thinking of? Because it had,
maybe,
you know, to destroy the barriers, you had to hit these little targets and take them out. And then the ball would blow up and, you know, you'd hit that electrified fence. Or maybe not. Maybe that was just me. That was what I always did, is I would destroy the wall. Because it had this electrified barrier. If you tried to push up, you would run the barrier and go, zhar, zhar, and it would zap you. And so I would destroy the wall, and I would push up, and I'd zap myself against the fence for, you know, like a split second before it went away. And, you know, it doesn't hurt you or anything. You know, it could mess you up big time if you were actually fighting enemies, but I would always, you know, do that.
Is this, am I remembering right, is this the game that's never been on Virtual Console?
This is the, yes.
That's just a travesty.
Yeah, I still can't understand it. I mean,
it's not a licensed product. It doesn't seem like there's a good reason why it shouldn't be on there.
Yeah, it's baffling. You know, Super C and Contra 3 have both been available on Virtual Console, but the original Contra has not been, and I don't understand why.
They're probably saving it for pachinko machines.
Because it's an unlockable bonus in Contra 4, also a great game. Contra 4 on
for
DS.
For the DS.
If you play through, you know, some of the challenge modes, you unlock the original Contra. So it's like, okay, clearly they have the ability to, you know, emulate this great classic NES game, but they decided, no, we're just not going to.
That's
not available
shame.
On Virtual Console. So, I mean, Konami, you know, they've made a lot of questionable choices recently, and that is certainly perhaps one of the top ones among them. Why not allow that one out there? But, yeah, it's such a fun game. And, you know, one of the all-time great power-ups, the spread gun.
Oh, it was spread gun or bust. I couldn't care less about the laser. I wanted the spread gun.
Laser was okay. Yeah, that maybe is my second favorite weapon. But, yeah, it was all about the spread gun. Yeah, especially if you were rocking the Advantage joystick. That would, you know, that and spread gun, boy, you could just really take out those enemies there. You know, fun variety of levels, you know, some neat bosses. Excellent game. And yeah, it would be great if there was a way to play that on modern consoles.
Come on, Konami.
I do still, that's probably the game I play on the NES, my actual old NES, more than anything else, because, you know, it's not available any other way. I mean, the arcade versions have had some ports, because it was an arcade game before it was an NES game. But I prefer the NES game better. I think it's you know, just more fun to play. It moves smoother. The jumping is less awkward. And so, yeah, that's the one I'm likely to fire my NES to actually play at home. Mm-hmm. Next up, number 9, Metroid.
Now, this is a game that has aged poorly because...
It has.
If nothing else, I mean, even putting graphics aside and maybe some of the advanced features of more recent Metroid titles, you didn't have a map. You basically had to draw your own map or maybe go buy one at Nintendo Power.
Mm-hmm. But no, you'd see the maps in the official Nintendo Player's Guide.
Yeah.
That's where you tended to see that one. That was one of the main reasons to buy that wonderful tome.
So I don't know if it's a game that I would recommend people go out and play now for the first time. But I just had to give credit to it on this list because back in the day, I mean, when I first played it, it was so revolutionary.
You're looking at it from a historical perspective and putting that into context. You know, it was such an amazing game at the time. And, you know, like we said about, you know, Kid Icarus, it was part of that, you know, Silver Box Adventure series. You know, it was one of the first notable games with a password, and just this whole exploration element. It was so fantastic, even though it's been completely surpassed by Super Metroid and you know, Metroid Zero Mission, the straight up remake that was on GBA.
It's one of the few, like the small handful of games on the NES that I can vividly remember, just burning an impression into my mind as I played it. Like it was so new and so good. And I was just so obsessed with it that I just couldn't leave the TV. I just had to play it all the time until I beat it, despite the fact that I would occasionally write down an O instead of a zero in the password and completely screw myself.
Yeah, that was the worst thing about it, I suppose, aside from not having a map, was that convoluted password. There were like some letters I couldn't even tell what letter they were supposed to be. I remember just sort of like, you know, drawing it out. And it actually changed the way I wrote. Like, You know, I made sure that, you know, I crossed my Z's ever since that game because that way I wouldn't confuse a Z with a 2.
But for me, that game was really about two things. It was and I couldn't even identify this back in the day, but looking back on it, that spooky kind of mood and atmosphere. And it wasn't just necessarily creepy.
Yeah, totally.
But you really had this strange kind of feeling of isolation and aloneness, which was weird. Mm-hmm. That, again, I couldn't have put a finger on it back then, but they've really gotten away from that in more recent Metroids, and I wish they'd get back to it.
Mm-hmm. That the kind music of, really helped drive that home, too. It just had this, you know, sort of mysterious, semi-creepy kind of vibe to it.
It had this sense of presence.
Haunting.
Like,
it was kind of haunting.
It wasn't telling a story, but it kind of was. Like, your mind kind of filled in the gaps, and it was immersive in kind of a way that NES games usually weren't. And also the fact that, like, you talked about before was how... you had to explore the environments. You know, we talked last episode about how NES was still such an early console. They were introducing all these new concepts as the technology started to evolve a little bit. And, you know, we went from single-screen games on the Atari when you're just trying to get a top score to games where you could actually scroll the screen and have whole, you know, separate levels in games like Super Mario Brothers. And then here was a game that put the whole game world, basically all the levels from a regular game, into one big area that you could just run and explore, you know, not necessarily in any order because you had to unlock certain parts first, but eventually you get to the point where you can just run and backtrack through the whole game. And it'd be a hassle again to play today because you really back then I kind of, you know, used graph paper to make my own map and stuff.
I remember doing that same thing except my levels would never line up because, you know, it had like, you know, three different, you know, horizontal or three different vertical levels. I didn't realize these were the same one, and I'd have them, you know, not lined up properly and be like, wow, I'm really lost now. What's going on here?
I think in the end, I just backtracked through so much of it so many times that I just started to intuitively know where I was. So, you know.
It took me a long time to beat that game, like years and years, well after the NES was past its prime before I actually beat it.
Oh, wow. I played it I beat it during its heyday, and that's maybe, I think, why I still have such a great appreciation for it.
Number 8, Castlevania III, Dracula's Curse.
Probably my all-time favorite Castlevania game of any type. Mm. It's pretty much the ultimate. I mean, it's not as pretty as Super Castlevania IV on the Super NES, mm-hmm. but I love the branching paths, the fact that it has different levels you can experience on different playthroughs, that mm-hmm. you can unlock different characters that you can turn into.
Playable characters, I love that. Alucard.
Including Alucard, but my favorite was the pirate who could climb upside down on ceilings
Grant
and on walls
Denasty.
And stuff. Yeah.
He and was great when you were climbing on the ceilings until you, like, sometimes I just had, like, a weird slip of the thumb and I would just plummet to my doom. It's like, darn it, what did I do there? I don't recall letting off the control pad. I'm dead.
It was a really hard game. But I think it's also Koji Igarashi's favorite Castlevania title. The guy
who we talked about on the show before.
Yeah, who was pretty much ran that series since Symphony of the Night onward. Mm-hmm. Up until the Mercury Steam titles.
Yeah, and he actually made a direct sequel to it on PlayStation 2 called Curse of Darkness. Castlevania Curse of Darkness was the direct follow-up to
this title. I don't know if I knew that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the second PS2 game. But just talking about this one, and you know, it seemed like they really were able to push the NES with this one. It had some, you know, spectacular graphics. You know, I remember those stained glass windows and like that, I guess it was a church that you were going through like on the first stage, and some excellent music. Although reportedly the Japanese version music is even better.
Yeah, I think, was this a Famicom Disk System game in Japan?
I can't remember.
I think it's something like that, and that's why
I
had a better soundtrack.
Games were, but I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah, I've never heard that one, but this one was pretty amazing. And I think you spoke about how some games were censored in back in the day in last week's episode, and I think this was one of the ones where they removed some crosses from the beginning.
Yeah, I think at the beginning he was, you know, like praying in front of a cross, but then it was like kneeling in front of a grave or something. Nothing you'd really, you know, notice unless you knew to be looking for it. But yeah, those were kind of some weird omissions. But yeah, lots of really cool stages. And like you said, there were branching paths, so sometimes it was really hard to get to these. But like the pirate ship, I thought that's one of my favorite levels in the game. Hard to get to, hard to get through, but yeah, it's a neat idea for a level and a cool concept. Haunted pirate ship.
Yep.
Good times.
Definitely my favorite Castlevania. One of my all-time favorite side-scrolling action games.
I don't know if it's definitely not my favorite Castlevania, but you know, it's certainly a great entry in the series. Next up, number 7, Super Mario Brothers 2.
The oddball in the Super Mario series.
Yeah, it is.
Because it wasn't originally a Super Mario game, as most people know.
Yeah, we've talked about that. It's very common knowledge. It was originally
Doki Doki Panic.
Yes. And then I got reskinned for the USA, put in some Mario characters. But you know
what? Sounds like a recipe for disaster, but it's an amazing game.
It's an excellent game. And I know we've talked about this before. We've done our Mario episodes. But, you know, it's such a weird thing when you go and it's like, okay, I see a shy guy, gonna take care of him. And you jump on him. It's like, oh, he didn't get squished. This is really weird.
Yeah.
And the whole play mechanic of grabbing and throwing him or throwing a vegetable at him or, you know, whatever you're doing. But it's all about, you know, grabbing and throwing and beating stuff down with vegetables, really. But it was a fun play mechanic, really fun play mechanic.
And, you know, it's one of the first games that I can remember where you could choose a different player character that each had a different attribute at the start.
Yeah, that was neat. You know,
Luigi could jump high, Princess Peach could float, or Princess Toadstool back then.
The fact that you could play as her, you know, in the sequel, it's like, oh, before she was just a damsel in distress. Yeah. And, you know, so, and Toad kind of was too.
And we can't say enough that we want to see that boss come back from Super Mario Brothers 2.
Wart?
Wart, yeah. I couldn't think of his name for a second. The giant toad who you beat by throwing vegetables in his mouth.
Yes. Yeah, I'd love to see him come back in you know, Mario Kart or Smash Brothers or something like that. I mean, apparently just a figment of Mario's imagination because he found the whole thing is just a dream at the end.
Yeah.
But
with an amazing ending screen. Like that full screen animation of Mario snoring in bed was a technical feat at the time.
Mm-hmm. But hey, it turned out that the bombs were in other games, and you know, some of the other characters have been in other titles as well. So.
Well, Shy Guys,
yeah,
and Birdo. Mm-hmm. I mean, that game introduced a lot that, even though
absolutely.
It wasn't originally a Mario Brothers game, added a lot to the canon, and the music as well. A lot of the music that we get, or some of the refrains, come from that title as well.
Yeah, every time I hear, you know, these little Mario 2 musical cues in Mario Maker, it's like, man, I kind of wish there were a whole, you know, Mario 2 aesthetic theme I could choose from.
Yeah, maybe this speaks to the impact of the game on the franchise, but I unlocked, in Mario Maker recently, I unlocked one of the amiibo costumes. Well, this one isn't an amiibo costume. You unlock it by, you know, playing 100 Mario Challenge, but I unlocked Shy Guy, and it was only then that it occurred to me that normal Shy Guy as an enemy isn't in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like a really strange omission, but, you know, I guess they felt it was necessary since the game didn't really support Super Mario Brothers 2.
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't make sense in Mario Maker context because it's a completely different play mechanic. But, you know, it is a terribly fun play mechanic, whether it was originally supposed to be Mario or not. You know, you're climbing vines, you're digging through deserts, you're, you know, tossing, you know, mushroom-shaped blocks at three-headed monsters and weird rock-throwing crabs.
Grabbing keys and running from phantom masks.
Oh, man, that part. Yeah.
That's pretty terrifying.
Nightmares. Yeah.
And
of course, it was the, you know, the first issue of Nintendo Power cover story.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I'm You know, I'm ultimately glad that the series went back to its kind of more traditional style with Super Mario Bros. 3, but I have longed for a true direct sequel to Super Mario Bros. 2 or Doki Doki Panic, if they want to go back to calling it that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But those that kind
I'd
of play style,
totally down with that.
You know, that play style never really got, I never got enough of it to get tired of it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Number 6, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. Not regular Punch-Out featuring Mr. Dream, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Yeah, I always thought it was a rip. I guess their contract expired with Mike Tyson and later versions of the game couldn't have him in it. And to be honest, the guy turned out to kind of be a monster in real life.
Yeah, I think that's probably the main reason his name, you know, was no longer
he
on
bit,
there.
I think his name disappeared around the time he bit Evander Holyfield's ear off.
Well, and, you know, he ended up, you know, being a convicted criminal as well.
Yeah.
So.
But still, you know, I finally remember playing Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he was such a popular figure at the time, even if he didn't like boxing, everybody wanted to see Iron Mike knock a guy out in 20 seconds.
And you want to be able to say you beat Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Saying you beat Mr. Dream, you know, it's an equally hard feat. But to be able to claim that you beat Mike Tyson, man, that carries, you know, a lot more weight, I feel.
And beating Mike Tyson in that game is probably one of the hardest things you could ever attempt to do in a video game.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You had to have split-second reflexes to see that little wink and know he was about to deliver a potentially crushing blow that you had to duck out of the way of.
Well, I mean, when he did start doing the wink, the fight became a lot easier, but earlier on, he's just like just doing the shuffle, and then he punches, and one hit, and you're down.
Yep.
I'm getting sweaty palms just thinking about it.
But here was a game that was the rare game that you had no fodder enemies. It was basically all boss fights.
I guess you could think of it that way.
And they all have the characters were giant, you know, for the NES.
Yeah.
And detailed.
Big characters.
And they each had their own personalities. Mm-hmm. I mean, in most games, you're facing an endless wave of guys coming at you or doing the same stuff. This one was like, okay, punch this guy in the stomach, and he's going to keep dropping shorts, and you keep punching him in the stomach again. Bald Bull's going to charge at you. Be ready and hit him at this right moment.
Yep.
And there's so much strategy into what you'd think, looking at it at first glance, would be such a straightforward game.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, it's not really a sports game. It's more like, you know, a puzzle game in some sense. And that's what I think made it so appealing.
Yeah, and that's what I mentioned this on the last episode, but that's what I wish, you know, not that we'd move away from sports sims of today, but that there would also be arcadier sports options for people who honestly don't know sports in great enough detail to play these sims. Where are the double dribbles, the blades of steels, the Mike Tyson's punch outs, you know, of today? I mean, you can have a lot of fun and kind of feel from a layman's perspective like you are really boxing in a game like Punch Out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. But, I mean, I don't like, you know, really sports games at all, yet I love Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. So I think that really, you know, speaks to the kind of appeal that title had.
Definitely.
Next up, number 5, Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link.
Another oddball 2 titled sequel.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about Castlevania 2 and how much it deviated from the series, and then Super Mario Bros. 2, which we just mentioned, and then here comes this game as well, which was quite a departure from the original top-down-only Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, I mean, it still had that top-down map, but then you had an enemy encounter, and it would go into side-scrolling view for, like a random enemy encounter, and then you'd have, you know, side-scrolling caves and dungeons, or not dungeons, they were temples. They weren't actually called dungeons. And on top of that, you know, you didn't have the array of items to use either. I mean, there were a couple, but instead they had a magic system. And you leveled up, your strength and defense. And, it was very, very different, but I loved it.
I loved it, too. It is one of those games, though, that so much of it is great, and I love it. But there are a couple of what I consider questionable game design choices, and I really wish that this is a game that Nintendo had decided to remake or at least kind of, you know, tweak a little bit in a re-release at some point, because I feel that having to go back to the starting position every time you die on the map
that's not true, though. You actually had lives, so it's not, you were given 3 chances After the three chances are up, yeah, then you're sent back to the starting point. But it's not like The Legend of Zelda where you only had one life. So they tried to balance it out that way. So I give them props for that.
But it's too much. I feel like the game, I would say the best and worst part of the game is that it's part action game, part RPG. And I think they tried to make it action-y or more action-y in the way that they gave you, lives. And if you failed all of them, you have to go back to the start. And you'd occasionally, but very rarely, find an extra life, that kind of thing. But then I did like the mix of, like, when it was time to fight, you went into a side-scrolling view, and the temples were all side-scrolling view, and that was a really neat kind of change-up.
Yeah, I love that.
The temples were a little bit Metroid-y in that way.
Mm-hmm. But out of towns, you had to go through the towns. You would, talk to people. They'd give you clues. You'd meet guys who were error.
But see, I feel like a good, error. I am error.
Yes.
Classic character. But I...
error for Smash.
I would have thought that, if you're, halfway, most of the way through a temple and you lost all three lives, then just restarting at the start of the temple would have been the more appropriate
I will give
punishment.
You that, because it had this option. When you die, it had this thing called continue. It didn't do anything. It really meant back to the beginning, because it only worked when you were at the very final dungeon. Like, why couldn't you continue from the beginning of the other temples?
I mean, thankfully you did keep...
It was a weird choice.
Thankfully you did keep all of your gear and the levels up you'd gained. And
did you?
I mean, they didn't, knock you back down to level one on everything.
Oh, no, that's true.
True. And they had magic for the first time.
But you lost your experience. So if you had, 4,499 experience points before hitting that 450, threshold, or 4,500 threshold, or, something like that, you lost all that experience points. Like, oh, man, I was so close to leveling up.
So you wouldn't go down. You wouldn't lose fully acquired levels, but you'd
lose
the experience.
ESP.
Yeah.
And I remember, I had such a hard time with that game. It was really challenging for me, because it was one of the earliest games I got. And I remember just, level grinding, because parts were too tough for me. I'm, just fighting, endless amounts of, small fry enemies in, these randomish battles. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I'm going to kill... 300 slimes now so I can level up.
I felt it was really unforgiving in the controls. I love doing the downward thrust on bad guys.
Oh, yeah, downward thrust
was
great.
Like on those Iron Knights or whatever.
Fun move.
But you really had to nail the exact timing of that jump and that thrust, because he couldn't jump very high.
You think?
Yeah.
Downward thrust was always great.
Well, I always had trouble with it. But or just with the game in general. I mean, I thought it was a very tough game in a lot of ways.
It was a tough game. And as I think I mentioned before, I remember my, game file, it would say how many times you'd tried. And it was I had died 250 times in the attempt.
But I did.
Again, I love it despite what it put me through at the time. Maybe a much better gamer, I think.
Personally, I it was torture waiting for that game, because
that's right.
I was the biggest Zelda fan. And the very first time you saw or even heard about this game was in the Player's Guide.
Yeah.
Before Nintendo Power, they released that one kind of thick black covered book that just had all these hand-drawn maps in there of the most popular games. And they had them for this game, which didn't come out for quite a while after that.
I think maybe it had, maybe it was just coming out in Japan or something, but it was a year and a half before it came out in the U.S.
Yeah.
It was the middle of 87. Didn't come out until the end of 88.
And then it finally comes out, and it has that kick-ass drawing of Link on the box, and I'm super stoked to play it.
What are you talking about? It was another golden box. There was no Link on the box.
Oh, you know what I'm thinking
smoking?
Of? I'm actually remembering the art that was used for the cover of Nintendo Fun Club. I don't know.
That might have been the box of the Japanese version.
Maybe,
but
you're right.
It was some cool hand-drawn art. It was cool that they aged Link up. He was not a kid anymore.
Yeah.
He had pants.
And I like that.
He had pants.
I like that he was older and had pants. And so the game comes out, and my grandmother says she'll buy it for me, but she won't give it to me until Christmas. And my best friend got it the same day, but he could play it straight away.
Oh, man.
So he's bringing the manual to school, and I'm reading it in lunch, and he's telling me about it, and I'm just kind of trying not to hear too much. Then he finally calls me up, and he's playing the game, and he's at the last boss, Shadow Link, but he can't get past him. And I actually suggested a technique that ended up helping him beat him without having seen the game. I told him, you know what? This works in some games against bosses. Just go back in the far left corner, duck down, keep hitting your sword, and see if he just runs into it enough till he dies. Sure enough, it worked.
See, I was waiting for the game for such a long time also. And I didn't know it actually come out, because it seemed like it was just taking forever. And back then, we were experiencing supposedly this chip shortage. So all these games
The old NES chip shortage.
Yeah. It's like, oh, when's this going to come out? Oh, there's a chip shortage. That's what's been delayed by forever. And so I didn't realize it was out. And so when I got it for Christmas, I was just shocked. I'm like, I didn't even know this game was out yet. How did you get this for me?
The best kind of Christmas surprise.
Yeah, yeah. So I had a blast. And I think I've mentioned before, you know, Legend of Zelda, you know, I kind of appreciate it, but it's like, what's up? I just couldn't get into the whole top-down thing. I had this weird bias at the time. But Zelda 2 is like, oh, awesome side-scrolling. It's the Zelda formula, but turned into a side-scroller. Perfect for me, and it totally was. And, yeah, it was great.
Just like with Super Mario Bros. 2, I'm glad that the Zelda franchise, like the Mario franchise did, went back to more of the traditional gameplay with the follow-ups to those games. Mm-hmm. But I do have a unique fondness for Zelda 2, and I really wish they had, you know, at some point done like a side series game that was a direct sequel and where they brought that gameplay style back.
Yeah, I also wouldn't just mind, you know, some sort of remake that, you know, tackled the same content but maybe made it more traditional. Maybe that'd be weird, but or see it revisited in some way for sure.
Or a Super Mario All-Stars level remake that's just like, you know what, here's slightly better
totally
sprite tiles.
I think we talked about that before too.
And now you don't.
I would love that.
And now you don't get back to the very beginning if you die in a temple.
Number 4, Super Mario Brothers.
This is the game, I've said this before, this is the game that made me a gamer.
Yeah, like, me too.
Like most kids, I loved Atari, and I probably had more Atari games than most kids. And when Atari crashed, I was buying up $5 Atari games at like Rite Aid like crazy.
See, I wasn't. I was like, okay, you know, this was an all right hobby, but it's got a ways to go. Yeah. And then Mario came out, and I'm like, holy crap.
Well, I think that's what it was. I think Atari was more like, wow, I'm moving something on the TV screen. It was more of just like, look what science can do.
Yeah, it was kind of like a tech demo.
Yeah, but Super Mario Brothers was like, holy crap, video games are the best. Mm-hmm. And I didn't buy the system for it. I'd never played it before. I got the system for, you know, primarily to play Kung Fu and Excitebike because I love those in the arcade. But man, when I played Super Mario Brothers for the first time, it was just magic.
Yeah, you know, we did a Super Mario retrospective not too long ago, so I'm not going to get into it again. But yeah. I mean, when I played this, that was what sold me on the NES, and, you know, everything continued on from there. It became my number one hobby, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If it weren't for that, you know, I never would have wound up in Nintendo Power.
And it still plays great. I recently just played through the whole thing without warping, and, you know, the graphics are rusty and all that stuff, but it had physics that were ahead of its time, and it's just so well made. It's still a game you can have a lot of fun with.
Number 3 on the list, the original Legend of Zelda.
The only game that maybe matches Super Mario Brothers for me in terms of like that little kid mesmerized in front of the TV for weeks that kind of just took over my life was The Legend of Zelda.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe. And again, when that game came out, we're used to just run from left to right and kill things. Mm-hmm. Zelda was like, oh, go in any direction you want, but you got to figure this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to tell you what to. And it's more challenging and less linear and more demanding of a player than pretty much any Zelda game we've had in the last couple decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was the kind of game where, you know, they made it intentionally for, you know, people, you know, just to talk about it, like at school, and be like, oh, did you try this? Yeah, I heard you could, you know, like burn this bush over here and do this thing.
Yeah, Miyamoto has said that. It was like pre-internet. He wanted it to cause a social conversation.
Yeah, and boy, did he ever. Yeah, it was, you know, a very challenging game, and there was just so much to explore and uncover, and there was, you know, something cool and mysterious around, you know, every corner, it seemed.
In one of the first, if not the first, games that you could actually save your progress onto a battery.
Mm-hmm.
It introduced so many things, and like I said, I'll just never forget the impression it made on me.
Yeah, I mean, this is another one where, you know, if nothing else, it belongs, you know, at the top of the list for, you know, its important place in gaming history, and you know, how much it you know, changed the landscape and gave birth to, you know, a phenomenal series.
And that gold box and that gold cartridge.
Yeah, yeah.
That I mean,
really
right out of
it.
The gate, Nintendo was telling you this is something special.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
all the rules.
Boxes were one thing, but gold cartridge is another.
Yeah. And it didn't even have the traditional, like, artwork on the front. It was very elegant for its time. It was just the title and had the little die-cut window on the front of the box. You could see that the cartridge was gold.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never heard about this game. The first exposure I had to it was seeing it on the wall at Toys R Us, And I was like, I have to have this. It's like the gold standard of NES games.
I had, you know, heard about it. I remember the TV commercials, probably where I first heard about it, you know, with the guy running around with saying like the enemy
names, yeah,
you know, Tektites. That's the one everyone remembers.
Zelda.
Octorox.
And it came with this fat full color manual with these awesome like anime illustrations inside, and it had a map, a fold out map.
Ended up buying it used, so I don't think I ever had that.
Yeah, the map, I think, had a seal you had to break, so you had to, like, admit that you were going
to
cheat.
So I remember there was something like that in Link to the Past, but I didn't realize the original came with that as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah, awesome game. Number two, Mega Man 2.
Now, you're the bigger Mega Man fan by a mile between us, but I do really, really love Mega Man 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it took what worked really well in the original game, that you know, rock, paper, scissors formula, the taking the boss's powers, and it just, you know, cranked up everything. You know, it had more levels. It had probably more variety in the weapons.
Giant bosses at the end.
Yeah, there are a couple massive you know, bosses for the NES when you got to the Dr. Wily stages. That huge dragon is so cool, and the big old Guts Dozer. They added in, you know, these additional you know, tools you could use. There was the magnet beam in Mega Man 1. This gave you the three items, the hovering platforms, the wall-crawling elevator, and just the hoverboard that you would use to get across, you know, like the big gap in Heat Man stage. And, you know, the music was really, really phenomenal. They, you know, improved the graphics quite a bit.
Yeah, they were able to achieve these kind of brighter colors I didn't remember ever seeing on previous NES games at the time. And I remember comparatively, the original Mega Man game seems really dull when you put it next to Mega Man 2. And specifically, I always remember the Mega Man 2's Air stage, or Airman stage, where it has this white puffy clouds, bright blue sky.
Yeah, and the clouds are animated. They're, you know, pulsating a little bit.
And then you're jumping on these platforms with faces that have like this bright apple red. You know, and you go back and you look at the sky in Super Mario Brothers, the original, which was one of the first games to have like a blue sky, but it's kind of purpley and kind of muted. But then you look at this Mega Man 2 sky, and it's like vibrant and blue and colorful, and the graphics really blew me away at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely one of the best looking titles.
Catchiest music.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, my favorite part, you know, big spoiler alert if you've never played this 20-something year old game, was the final boss. And you know you're trying to track down Dr. Wily, and you know you get to him in the well, first you defeat him in one you have to go through a robot gauntlet. You have to take out all the bosses. You have to take out Dr. Wily and his Wily machine, and then he flies off in his saucer, and like, oh, that it was so cool, cuz on the world map there was not a world map, but it was a map of, you know, Dr. Wily's castle, and it showed you moving from point to point, and then here's a skull symbolizing here's the end. And you defeat Dr. Wily there, and then it goes back to the map, and it draws a second skull on the path. It's like, oh, man, there's more to it. Oh, you totally tricked me. And so you go through this last level. You get to the end. It's this dark room. Dr. Wily comes down, and he turns into an alien. And it's like, oh, my God, Dr. Wily was an alien the whole time. And then you defeat him, and you discover it's just a hologram, and Dr. Wily is not actually an alien. But at the time, it was like the most amazing thing.
It's a double twist.
And it's still like one of my favorite game moments of all time. I love it.
And just that was the game, wasn't it, as well, that has the title screen, that classic shot of going up the skyscraper.
Oh, yeah,
you get
to
the top, and you see
Often
Mega
imitated,
Man.
Never duplicated.
Yeah, classic. Classic NES imagery right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the music it has at that part, and it also ties into the ending theme as well. Yeah, really, really good stuff. That is why I probably bought that game like 10 different times over the years. Like, you know, I have it on the NES, on PlayStation, on like, you know, four different compilations, et cetera, et cetera. But always worth it every time.
And now we're down to number one.
Number one.
Now, people who have been paying attention have to know there's one classic major NES title that we've yet to include on this list.
That's right.
And that is Bart Simpson.
For the Space Mutants?
Yeah. Did I didn't tell you I put that as number one?
Oh. No, I didn't realize that. You sure it's not Bart versus Radioactive Man?
Maybe it was that
what
one.
About Bart versus the World?
It was one of the Barts.
You know what? This is no good. Let's take that out. How about Super Mario Brothers 3?
Yeah, all right.
Okay, then.
Yeah, I like that version better. Super Mario Brothers 3. For the longest time, the best-selling, I think it held the record for being the best-selling video game ever.
Yeah, I think that's true. And for good reason, because it took that beloved Mario formula and, you know, really, really carried it to the next level.
And like we said, Super Mario Bros. 2 was kind of a weird offshoot game. 3 was more of a direct evolution of the original Super Mario Bros. You put those two games side by side, you can't believe that you went from that, you know, the original Super Mario Bros. On the NES, to Super Mario Bros. 3 on the same system.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks like it would have been at least on like the console that came after the NES.
Yeah. I mean, granted, it was like 5 years between those two games in the U.S., but the difference is just staggering.
Yeah, and the way they did it was they kept adding new chips to the cartridges, so even mm-hmm. though they'd basically be putting coprocessors into the games themselves to help get
like
more out of the system.
MMC1 chip or MMC3 chip or something like that. But it made stuff be, you know, really, really vibrant.
So much more stuff, so many more levels, so much more content, so many more things you could
map.
Do.
Yeah. I mean, before it was just, you know, those 32 levels, 8 worlds with 4 levels apiece. And this, you know, you had a world map. You could, you know, go to, you know, these mini fortresses in the middle. You could fight these, you know, optional, you know, little hammer brothers. You had your regular levels. You had the toad houses where you get extra power-ups. Yeah, it was just, you know, so much crazy stuff mixed in there. The only thing missing was a good save feature because there was, you know, so much. It was hard to go through in a single playthrough.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. It's one of the best technical feats of the system that you had gameplay that was that complex with that many levels, with a world map and all this stuff packed into one cartridge on an NES.
Yeah, the raccoon suit. It let you fly.
It introduced the raccoon suit, the tanuki suit. Introduced a lot of things. I mean, Mario couldn't pick up shells until that game.
Right.
You
could pick up other things in Mario 2, but this is a different play mechanic altogether.
Right. And it's pretty much a perfect video game. I mean, taking, you know, obviously there's been better systems that have had prettier graphics and maybe even smoother controls, but given the limitations of the NES, it's pretty much the perfect NES game. Again, if you could say, if maybe it'd be a little more perfect.
It's hard to argue with that. It also introduced the Koopalings, Bowser's children.
As they were referred to in the manual, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Been
retconned since then.
Yeah, I think the line in the manual is something like, "We're Bowser's kids. We love being mean."
They all had last names back then, too.
Well, it was just Koopa, I think. Wendy O. Koopa. Morton Koopa Jr.
Yeah, but Morton Koopa. Yeah, I guess you're right. Morton Koopa Jr.
But he lost his Jr.
Yeah.
And Wendy O lost her O. I think those are the things. That's probably what you're thinking.
Yeah, because they were all patterned off real people.
Most of them certainly.
Morton Koopa Jr. I mean,
obviously we know who he is.
Yeah. So I think later on, Nintendo's legal department maybe said we shouldn't be continuing this in future games.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, it gave us the airships. We've talked about how much I like the Hammer Brothers suit, the frog suit.
Man, the airships and the tank levels could be really tough.
They could. I appreciate being able to save anywhere on Virtual Console now. So, you don't have to keep your console on overnight and do it all in one sitting like that. But it's a phenomenal game.
Yep. Our best NES game, the official Power Pros top NES game of all time.
Well, that was a lot of games. I hope people enjoyed listening to our top 30 list, our top 15 on this particular episode.
And check these games out. I mean, you don't have to be, have been playing NES 30 years ago to enjoy these titles. A lot of them hold up pretty well on Virtual Console.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're going to wrap up this episode, but of course, before we do that, it's going to be time for a dramatic reading, this time from another NES class that didn't quite make the top 30, Duck Hunt.
Take aim, fire, and score. It's Duck Hunt. Your trusty hunting dog wades into the marshes to flush out your prey. Your fingers tighten around your Zapper light gun. Suddenly, there's a duck in the air. You've only got 3 shots to bag this duck, and if you miss, even your dog laughs at you. But become a sharpshooter, and you'll progress to the next round, where 2 ducks fly up at the same time. And then, you're on to the ultimate challenge, clay shooting, where you'll compete in a wild clay pigeon shooting contest. Play Duck Hunt and discover you can have lots of laughs and be challenged at the same time.
You know what I was thinking when I hear that game is that same friend that I loaned pro wrestling to the first night I owned it told me once that his father got addicted to Duck Hunt and played it until he got to a really high level.
Didn't he do something horrible?
He got to a really high level, lost, the dog laughed at him, and he yanked the NES zapper out of the NES and threw it against the wall and it shattered.
Well,
Duck Hunt, breaking families apart.
Nintendo only knew how infuriating that dog could be.
Yep. For years, I thought I wanted to kill that dog, but now I kind of find him adorable in Smash Brothers.
Now we've got his amiibo.
Yep, now I've got his toy. All right, well, that's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can also follow The Hoff on Twitter at ChrisTheHoff, and I'm at Chris Slate. Hoff also has a cool blog called Still Playing with Power. You can find it at ChrisTheHoff.tumblr.com. And go ahead and shoot us an email at powerprospod@gmail.com. We promise we will get to them eventually. And if you like the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you'd stop by iTunes and rate it.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Slate.
See ya.
And our main man, Mario.
Bye-bye.
We will see you next time.